Oh, it's going. Even though it's been turned off. You can't control it. Okay, it's Sunday, June 24th, 2019.
We're talking about a continuation of the man gone. Anyway, there was my friend Gabriel Brody, known as Gandhi. He believed that he was an entity. And I really was not very sophisticated about jazz. I never understood the people who lived in the same building, even like Charlie Parker. One day Charlie was jamming down in the boiler room and was hollering down, "Shut up! I have to work in the morning, and why don't you go back to Africa?" And so the jazz I began to not necessarily understand but enjoy and crave, and I thought this was like au courant, the music of America. But it wasn't really. This was an this was a 20th century creativity, or what have you.
I'm not sure about the word you used back there. You thought it was
au courant,
what's that?
Au courant, the current
thing. Au courant. Okay, yeah. French, right, got it. Okay.
And so here I am among people, once again, suffering great hardship with the police, driven out of the cities, you know. We had a rapport with them, and anyway, the guy who was constantly explaining all this to me was Gandhi Brody. And one day, I really don't know what horizons that Gandhi viewed in life, but there was no end to his energy, no end to his hatred of rich kids who would come onto the scene, which I may have inherited from him, and the belief that he could do anything. And I never realized the scale of his ambition, because he decided to enter a famous talent contest at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. This sounds perfectly routine, but to go into Harlem and to sing the blues to black people was, how can you pin that down? What would amount to this in real life? The Duke Ellington was the backup band for Friday night talent show.
The Duke?
Yeah,
Duke
Ellington.
Oh,
yeah. And when an act was failing, a huge hook would come out of the wings and drag the unfortunate performer into obscurity. But of course, many famous actors come to us from this junction, this show. Well, I went to see Gandhi perform, and it was a fiasco. The first note, there were boos and shouts and people throwing soda cans, and people assured me this was the worst response to an entertainer, an amateur, that they'd ever seen. But when the hook came out, Gandhi grabbed a hold of it and started dancing. And in a flash, people started cheering him. And I mean, this was really an invincible fellow. And he had a very comic dance, the only one that I've ever seen kind of replicate or do that. Is Martin, that comedian, Steve Martin. Mm-hmm. He has it. It's like sometimes I look at my dog and he's relaxed and happy and wants to play, and his entire body reflects this with a kind of dance that that comedian has and that Gandhi has. It's just, how do I describe what turned on people? I mean, how long does it take to drag you from center stage into the wings of this bloody hook, you know? And of course, it was really a triumphant thing. He won a consolation prize for his dancing. I mean, this had to be given to the audience to convince him in a matter of seconds, and it did. It was electrifying. And hence my friendship with Billie Holiday, who was there, my friendship with Duke Ellington, who was the band to this. He strike a merry note, you know, and see if these people got rid of us. The audience drowned out as possible with the latest song.
You say your friendship with Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington, what do you mean? Can you say more about that?
Yeah. Gandhi was really the bridge of transmission to these people. The glory of what happened to the Apollo Theater will be remembered by the people who saw it. They never forget that 15-minute walk where they slowed up the hook so that he could dance and kick. Well, anyway, so he knew these people. And one day, he called me up and said, we've got to help Billy. She needs help. And I thought, oh God, no, not a drug offense. I'm in the country legally. I can't do anything. You know, the cops are going to crowd the sidewalk. And I said, well, what do you want, Gandhi? He said, she needs clothing. You know, she buys things in a scandalological way. And I told her about you. I have a friend who works in the garment industry. She works with Philip Mangan. And he can examine the garments or alter them, you see. And you got to dress up and go with her because she wants to go to his clothing store is across from the plaza. Is that Bloomingdale? It is Bloomingdale.
It's in that vicinity, yeah.
Then that's it.
But there are a number of them along in there.
There's a street, but if you walk,
yeah.
But if you're...
I think it is in that direction, right? You know, from the plaza. Kind
yeah,
of the city corner.
Yeah, if you're on the steps now, and to your right, there's Bloomingdale. And some other stores.
Saks is along near Bonwick.
No.
Okay, it's not along that close?
There's Bloomingdale. And across the way on 57th Street, where are we on 58th Street? You have Tiffany, so that's the neighborhood. And Gandhi had, I think he was really fearful that they would be humiliated.
Do you want to go to Bloomingdale?
Yeah.
And they would humiliate?
No, this was New York a half a century ago.
Okay. Oh,
black people didn't go there. I see these films, but it always seems to be a remake of history.
Right.
Harlem was a ghetto, and it was a bad situation. I don't know how to take you back in time. So anyway, we all meet, and they pick me up in a cab, and we wondered how they would treat me. And she walked in there, and she had such authority that no one, the people were respectful to her, attention to her. and she was really quite tough. She pissed off at somebody, man. She'd punch him, knock him out, you know. So anyway, there's none of this sort of angry back. She walked in as though she owned the place, and he thought, this is something. Maybe a black diplomat, African, or something. She had a great dignity about her. And anyway, I followed her about, and she chose him on songs. At that time, my cousin was working with an assistant designer, to Lottie Werner. I'm sure you've never heard the name Lottie Werner in design, but she created something called coordinates. Pants, waistcoat. We talk about stuff for ladies, sportswear, and you could go to the store once and buy a coordinates will take you right through the summer, and you can present a different appearance every other day.
By swapping these around.
By swapping these around. So I kind of introduced it to coordinates, but she didn't envision herself on a beach or any place. I don't know why that would be so, because the work entertainers do outside of New York in the hotels. The hotels, like Grossinger's, would have first class showing. But anyway, then a strange thing happened. I wondered why she didn't want to talk about this. And she was with Gandhi at the end of this row of coats and jackets. She was sort of whispering, and she looked at me, and I thought, you know, what's so bizarre about coordinates? This is new, and theatrical folks are open to what is new, you know, for their work. And she apparently told Candy that she is sure I was with the FBI. I had to assure her I was not with the FBI. But when this happened, the party was over, I said, this might go back to work. She didn't listen to me and be negative about something. Don't tell I'm in the country illegally, that any cop can arrest me, that there are warrants, and on this little island, you know the problems I have. Just tell her that this shouldn't happen again. I have my own conscience. So, yes, that's the circumstances in which I met her. And then she ran into problems with dope.
But so, it sounds like, so far, you weren't friends with her. It was more like you became acquainted with her through Gandhi, who was a
person. Yeah.
Something more like that.
Yeah. I stayed away from her because I just knew that the police were on her back, and that was part of New York at that time. It was a form of racism where you get someone who's above the rest and profile their politicians and entertainers, and you harass. So that I always felt a danger here, like being swept up.
You mentioned Duke Ellington, and you said
friendship with him, too. But so can you say something about what that was? What I could say about him was that he remembered the incident with Gandhi, the guy that he drug off stage and who began to dance and won over an audience and wanted him to come out and dance and dance. That was his revenge on him. And he would recognize me, but we would meet in musical situations, but not what you think would be a musical situation. We see Sam Goody stores all over America now, but once upon a time, about 50 years ago, there was only one Sam Goody, and he was in the Times Square area. I forget the street, I think it was 44th Street and 5th Avenue to West Loop. And he had a record store there, and every Saturday night, Sunday, musicians who had a cut of their work would go over to Sam Goody. The Duke would go over there, meet you in there, say hi, Al. And that was very nice. And he would be over there. Once I met Harry Belafonte, but I don't know him, he doesn't know me, he looked very glum over at Sam Goody. And we would always make this deal. Gandhi always felt that if he failed at painting, he could return and go back into show business. I assure you, he was a great artist. I see where they're making the fuss of his work now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, why were these people happy or glum at Sam Goody? Because Sam Goody had this huge board, like a graph, that would plot the course of the record. You know, the recent bit, they had records, no tape or anything like that.
The sale.
So the artists would go there to check on their sale. So on this occasion, Harry Belafonte had glum or Ben Follows or anyone. And the Duke would go by to find out how his latest cuts were going. And we'd meet him there and talk. You know, things. But I was not into his world. And the world that I physically lived in, whether I liked it or not, and I really didn't like it, was the world of Charlie Parker and all these people. And they were neighbors on Thompson Street. And I came to understand their music or the progress they were making. See. And I think the Duke was kind of removed from that. There was an urban charm and stuff. It was not apparent in the music. Abstract expressionist supported, and I mean we supported all of these
people. The jazz people.
The jazz.
Not the Duke
Ellington. No.
Okay. Struggling jazz artists.
Yeah. But they would enjoy dancing to Duke, you know, and speaking chairs, right?
My switch chairs?
Yeah. I was walking down Broadway, Times Square area, near a new kind of nightclub, which is named for Charlie Parker, called Birdman. We've been to Sam Goody, and we'd walk across the square and walk by Birdman. Sometimes you'd go in there. But we look at who was performing. On this occasion, there was a very distraught friend named Charlie Parker walking up down outside, as if he was manning a picket line without a picket line. And he was angry, and he said, "Man, can you believe this? I'm barred from going into Birdman." And it was true, he was messing up the gigs and things like that. He was into narcotics, so they told him, they threw him out that night. He was walking up and down. I thought, God, how a fate, how unfair it all is. We left and took this up like that to our haven, to village. I think we were the village Mangan people. At this time, Wally Cox was introducing himself to the people of America. He became a great beloved entertainer on TV and on shows. And he kind of started out as village Vanguard. And we'd run into his friend Marlon via the organ boxes. And we were proud of Marlon too, because he accepted the theory of Wilhelm Reich and the nomenclature, how you speak about this would come forth from his mouth without mumbling, or which he did so much in those days. He would say things like, "I have to overcome armoring. Society would have to overcome armoring. I believe that, as Wilhelm Reich believes, that what the world needs is a good buck. It needs an organism." And of course...
Organism?
Yeah.
Or orgasm?
Or orgasm. Anyway, this was part of another book that was... Actually, it was originally one famous in Germany, which followed me here, what the function of the book. Oh, okay. The orgasm.
Yes, right. That's what
orgasm.
You meant to, right.
Sorry.
That's what you meant to say.
Yeah.
Right.
The function of the organism.
Orgasm.
Ah, orgasm. God almighty, I have to check out this hang-up I have about things. It won him a measure of fame, and he, of course, is one of the three followers of Freud, with Jung and Reich.
And Jung didn't follow Freud. He wasn't a follower.
None of these guys were followers.
In the after,
but under this sort of new thing, they kind of came forth under this new respected umbrella of respectability or scholarship. And if you did something, you found you were the head of the movement. I think there was a British psychiatrist named Ernest Jones, who was a follower of
Freud.
Yeah. I mentioned the school earlier on that I went to, and Dr. Jones, I attended lectures with him by Dr. Jones.
So who attended lectures?
At the Toynbee Hall that I attended. So that was...
Would you say that again, because you used Dr. Jones' name, when you said Dr. Jones attended lectures by Dr. Jones.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, I attended some lectures that were given by Ernest Jones at Toynbee Hall. So that's some measure of Toynbee Hall. A controversial figure, but... I studied at Toynbee Hall, and we had the best teachers in the world. Alas, there was a British spy scandal in England that involved the a minister and. I can't think of his name. I remember the women he sort of was running around with, Mandy Rice Jones.
That was
one.
In the 60s. I would like to go back to New York.
Oh, okay.
And not get off on England right now.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about jazz and its connection to art, that in the life that you led, I guess in the early 50s, is that when you lived on Thompson Street? Is that right?
Yeah. We were attracted to the jazz musicians. We ignored the Dixieland jazz people, the people from New Orleans, except for certain virtuoso. We championed the Bird. Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker. We all of these people, what Bert represented, bringing something to you. I think it was
Miles Davis.
I went to see Miles Davis perform at Birdman, and most of the people there that night were people who were following the building up around in appreciation of the jazz. And from the beginning of the performance, Miles turned his back on the audience. We thought that was great. Because this would be very annoying. Have a guy blowing the trumpet and turns his back towards you. I mean, from an auditory point of view, this is not very good. It's kind of insulting. So anyway, and we heard he was doing this and getting kicked out of places because of this stuff and attitude. So the artist of the Caesar, there was a little store around the corner, the Italian grocery store, these scrubby little places, the kind of place where you'd have a mafioso don or an officer of that organization hiding behind piles of zucchinis and stuff like that, issuing orders to little footlongs. The don was closed down. I don't know why, he was probably arrested or something like that. And we decided that this would be an ideal place for a little night. And we spoke to him about that we were going to get this done. So, for a couple of nights, the Caesar bar was empty, people, because everyone was scrubbing the floors, incredible as this memory is. And some fellows who were pretty good at putting frames together and structures and sculptures, they're working in wood, that Nevelson lady. We flashing the little nightclub.
Nightclub?
Yeah. And brought Miles Davis down there. And I want to tell you about New York in those days. You didn't have blacks coming into the Caesar Tavern. So we led him into this place. This is yours. And he didn't know anything about this. The musicians knew about this, they contributed to the work. And we had camp stools and things like that and boxes to sit on. We had a big crowd, began to play, and then turned his back on. I had all sorts of explanations. Psychology of this by the experts, you know. But this was his place. Without, we paid the rent. I mean, we weren't in the position to pay anyone's rent, but this is a real bargain. Cold water, holding warm. This was his place. And we were his comrades. The bastard turned his back. What explanation do you have for that? We liked the musicians, we supported them. We learned never to let them into our homes.
Because?
They would steal things. They needed money for drugs. So we understand that, but we learned that it wouldn't be a good idea to let them in your house. Particularly if they had a space down, but, you know. And they all seemed to be into drugs. So I don't know any danger. about right. We supported the musicians unconditionally, but I mentioned hang-ups. This thieving stuff, you know. We enjoyed them. They seemed to musically do what we were about, and we looked to them for companionship. The other people that we, the Cedar Bar group, seemed to be involved with. I'll tell you this, no musicians came into the Cedar Bar, any black musicians. I've never seen a black musician either enjoying a drink or offering to play at the Cedar Tap. Other comrades were poets. Poets who there were two poets. One was a guy named Geller, G-E-L-L-E-R, and another poet named Galler, G-A-L-L-E-R. And Geller and Galler, after a while, didn't get on with one another, but they were a great help to us. I think Galler became an editor and went into publishing, and so did Geller. But at this time, they hoped to earn their bread with poetry, which I just might send me into a paroxysm of laughter. It wasn't to be. But they would help us by writing brochures.
Brochures for what?
For our catalogs. Okay. Yeah, sometimes it would be just the line. Just as we extract a line or a sentence from a review, you see, they were very good in this respect. And letters of outrage to the Greenwich Village claiming injustice done them. They were a component of the Cedar Bar. And another bunch of people came along who also became very good comrades. This would be the beatniks. Ginsburg and this other guy traveling all over America, and we welcomed them. There were five principal writers in that group, and one day I was at a party and there was who was that fellow wrote on the road? Jack Kerouac. Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Allen had just given a lecture at Columbia University, which was a great breakthrough for them. And after that, there were people who wanted to publish them, and this kind of vaulted them to fame. And Jack Kerouac, imperfect a fellow as he was, amongst writers, there was a breakthrough for his work, and as was the case with Pollock, there was a breakthrough to the people, you see. And they were, when they were unrecognized, they were very helpful to us, but the minute they got recognition, they got on with writing, which is a good thing. But they were always supportive, you know. I have no criticism of them, except they would drink like fish and then collapse, you see. And but during a 2-year period, they began to drink without vomiting over everything, so thereafter. I know this seems like a trivial thing, but it's not a trivial thing. We are men, you know, with women, lady comrades who helped clean up the mess, for Christ Almighty. But they were young. I mean, they were really young people. Well, I was young too. I arrived there when I was 21. You know, I had to put up with insults and things like this.
in the pecking order, you go right to the bottom. And there was a pecking order. And you can see it in the way people were seated in the Cedar Tavern, or where people stood at the end of the bar. That was the place where Franz Klein held for. But not really. You could never... he was friendly, he could talk to the end of time, but nothing would ever emerge. You know.
What was that story you told the other night about you connected it with a prize fighter?
Oh, yes.
Two-time Tony.
Yeah. I was an amateur boxer in England. I was just going to say undefeated, but I was defeated by a fellow named Johnny Sullivan, who became a world contender, so I'm proud.
What level was that?
That was as welterweight. Actually, I should say lightweight, but there's a pejorative thing about saying you're a lightweight, you see, so I just don't like... I'll tell people that I was a featherweight, and this is more acceptable than saying, well, I was a lightweight. It just... this decade, it doesn't fit into this decade. So we were welterweights. We were welterweights. He was a contender as a middleweight. Johnny Sullivan. Anyway, so I would always keep up with boxing in America and see prize fights. And I think I know more about American prize fighters than, well, the average citizen. They were my idols. There was one fellow who I idolized, and that was two-ton Tony Galenda from New Jersey. And Tony was a robust 260-pound giant with a massive pot belly. And he would arrive to do battle with a case of beer, or if it was just a six-round contest with a six-pack of beer. But and he would be doused in this. He would drink a beer throughout the fights. Anyway, reporters who he won an important fight and was scheduled to meet the world's heavyweight champion, who was Joe Louis. And they were testing his confidence in the matter and mentioning other opponents. And Tony said, I can beat that dude. And some reporter said, what about William Shakespeare? Yeah, I can kill the bum. And that was more often than not the intellectual level of conversations in the Cedar Bar. I once tried that trick after reading this in the New York Post on Herman Cherry, a painter from California, therefore a creature of suspicion and to be ostracized. And I said, well, so you think you're a better painter than Diebenkorn, right? Yeah. That guy can't paint the size of a barn. And I said, what about William Shakespeare? Oh, I can, yeah, I'm a painter, man. Just don't bring it. That guy can't paint the side of a panel truck, for Christ's sake. So, and that was the tenor of much of the conversation.
Including, like, Franz Klein.
No, not Franz Klein. Franz Klein and de Kooning were really locked in competition with that. The French, there were French artists that they were concerned with, who were imitating their work, like Mathieu.
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 How do you spell that?
M Athieu.
You have a first name?
No. Mathieu, in a way, pointed out, he taught us a lesson, all of us in the Cedar Barn, that non-objective painting could become automatic, you see. And Mathieu would hire a cinema or a theater and put an easel on the stage and do an automatic painting.
Well, Mata, you know that.
Not Mata.
But he was into automatism, another word for it, in the
40s. Yeah.
Early 40s. Along with Kirill.
Yeah. Yeah, we see this. We see, you know, the automatic.
Okay.
These were like, they're very personalized things. The British Queen, Queen Victoria, used to send these kind of phantasmagoric postcards, which she would hand paint, totally non-objective, very atmospheric, and it became a fashion amongst the ladies and citizens of England to respond to her mood with their own mood in these postcards. So you always have that. It's always fascinating, you know.
It's always rediscovered.
And
you said, okay, de Kooning and Klein were locked in some thing about some of the French painters.
The insults of the French intellectuals to this bunch in the Cedar Bar. André Malraux was made a minister without portfolio by de Gaulle.
But why was this a big concern to Klein?
Because when you do something that's, you know, unique or singularly unique, you discover that there are other one or two people who are on the same line.
Yes.
But they're restricted by a tradition that they cannot throw overboard, whereas you can. Yes, you find that you compete with one or two other people throughout the world.
So
yeah.
They would talk about this in the Cedar Bar?
Yeah, they would talk about Japanese painters who were doing phony Franz Kleins, for God's sakes.
They felt they were phony. Did they think they were being deliberately copied, or that it was just one of those collections?
They were doing these paintings. They knew the methodology of Klein, you see, how he used these calligraphic things, and then the sketching in of the work in white, you know, white on white, which would disappear with the drying. So, you know, there's a swiftness of work here, but you'd have lines that you had established, and you attack with the black.
But the Japanese,
though,
and Orientals have a long tradition of art that is
Zen painting, where a guy would meditate before the canvas, and then he'd leap up and hurl himself. But no, these were there's a certain rightness to them. There's a balance to the Zen paintings, but there was never the structure that Klein had of creating space, you know.
Volume.
Yeah. And their plasticity was raise them head and above these imitations. The Japs were doing work. So they were the first, you see. I'm trying to think of names. The Frenchman Soulage looked at the problem that Klein represented and felt that what these things needed was what the French called le saucier, that is, the museum look, you know, that you just can't do that. Hello, this is horrible. And Soulage was doing these textured paintings that had a, you know, a superficial resemblance to Klein. And for a moment, he was concerned about that. So, you know, would the dealers go with a Soulage, you know? And so there were these pretenders throughout the world, and yes, they were a concern. That is, when their paintings became valuable, they came under this kind of an attack.
But that was much later. They were still struggling a lot in the 50s, early
50s. Yeah, but it all changed within a year.
Yeah.
It just...
according to April, people that, you know, everything began to...
It changed overnight.
Why they felt they were being ripped off?
Okay, because there's constant, there's a communication between artists. If they are unknown, they are known to artists. They might be unknown to the public, but known to artists. And
especially perhaps in New York. I mean, everything began.
No, no. Let me give you a typical incident, and I won't counter it, but I'll explain what happened in New York.
Uh-huh.
In 1905, without support from any major gallery, and yet strongly supported by artists and none other, was Pablo Picasso. He brought forth Demoiselle d'Avignon, and displayed it in his studio. It was in his studio. This wasn't in the armory show or in an institution. And people came from all over the goddamn place. And that was his first step to fame, his own studio in Montmartre, of all places. And the people came, the artists came, not the people. Now come to America so many years later, to the 50s. Klein was unknown to the people, but known to artists. It's true that he didn't have a one-man show until his early